This is lecture number 9 by Alan McCrae on Jeremiah, lecture number 9. The assignment for next time relates to one chapter, but it has four parts to it. The chapter is Jeremiah chapter 31. The first part of it is, what, if anything, is predicted about Zion in this chapter? Second, what is predicted about Ephraim, or Ephraim, in this chapter? Number 3, what, if anything, is predicted about Judah in this chapter? And finally, number 4, what, if anything, is predicted about Israel in this chapter? Please give references to the verses in this chapter for answering the four questions that I have just given you. See, it all relates to one chapter, and the assignment just gathers together the material under these four headings: Zion, Ephraim, Judah, and Israel. Now, let's look for a minute at the questions that you just had for the exam. There were 7 questions. Let me go over them one by one. Number 1, discuss the historical background of the book of Jeremiah. This, of course, is very important for understanding this book. I wouldn't feel too badly if someone spent nearly half the time answering this question alone, but I didn't really expect you necessarily to put that much time in on it, of course. Given the main things, it is quite satisfactory. But it is a big question, and it is very important in understanding the book. Remember that the book begins about the middle of the reign of King Josiah, and it was a time when things were peaceful and the people were drifting into carelessness. It was then that God called Jeremiah to bring them back from their sin, back to remembrance of God. Then we have the death of Josiah, which begins an entirely different sort of period, one in which they were very much under the shadow of foreign aggressors. And at the death of King Josiah, we have his son, Jehoahaz, made king by the people, but he only reigned 3 months before the king of Egypt took him away to exile, and his older brother, Jehoiakim, was made king in his place. Then 4 years later, the king of Babylon came, and he made Jehoiakim swear fealty to himself, and took away some of the people, some of the leaders, into exile. I have already mentioned to you that Daniel was one of those who was taken at that time to Babylon. Then we had Jehoiakim, supposed to be subject to the king of Babylon, but all the time he was planning how he could get his freedom and scheming with the Egyptians to get that freedom. But after an 11-year reign, Jehoiakim's reign was ended, and he was succeeded by his son, Jehoiachin. Now, about the names Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin. The only difference in Hebrew between their names is the final M for Jehoiakim and the final N for Jehoiachin. But in English, for some strange reason, we spell the first one, that is, the end of the name of the first one, Jehoiakim, with a K-I-M, and the ending of the second name, Jehoiachin, C-H-I-N, which makes them much easier to recognize than if we just had a final N or a final M. But in Hebrew, as I said before, Jehoiachin and Jehoiakim, the only difference is one ends in an N and the other ends in an M. Nevertheless, we will continue to call them Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin. Now, about Jehoiachin, all the people thought he was the great hope of the nation. This young boy that they knew little about, well, he was going to be a wonderful man, not like his wicked father. But after 3 months, the king of Babylon carried him off and some of the people along with him to exile. The king of Babylon then appointed as king an uncle of his, Zedekiah. He was the third son of Josiah to be king. Nebuchadnezzar appointed Zedekiah as king, and Zedekiah reigned for 11 years. And at the end of that, the Babylonians came and besieged the land, destroyed Jerusalem, and carried all the people into exile. That's a rather large question, of course, but it's quite important as background. Then, question number 2. Briefly discuss 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 29. And since I said briefly, it is quite satisfactory if you only dealt with the one matter that we have mentioned in that connection, a matter which is rather important for interpretation. The fact is that the King James Version says that Pharaoh said to King Josiah, quote, "I'm not concerned with you. I've come up against the king of Assyria," end quote. But in the more recent translations, it says, quote, "I've come up to help the king of Assyria," end quote. And it's an exact opposite meaning, isn't it? But the fact is that the Hebrew preposition, which in Hebrew is al, just like our English word with, can have either meaning. For example, we fought with Germany 40 years ago, but we can say we fought with England against Germany 40 years ago. So we can use with in the sense of we fought with Germany, meaning against Germany, and we can use with saying we fought with England, meaning alongside of or with England. So with can mean against or as an ally, and that's the same with the Hebrew preposition al. So in a position like in this verse, the critics said the book of Jeremiah or the book of Kings must be wrong. But the thing that was wrong was our taking one of the two possible interpretations of that preposition al. Now, we know the facts and know that the other interpretation should be taken. Maybe if the translators, instead of saying, I have come to fight against him, should have said, I have come to fight with him, then that would have been better. The ambiguity would have remained, just as we have in Hebrew. We thought that the preposition might have meant against, but when we thought about it more and looked at the historical context, we can see that it can just as well mean on the side of. Now, the third question was, describe Jeremiah's relation to each king who reigned in Judah for any considerable length of time during his career. Now, the only ones who did were only three, of course. This question really doesn't apply to Jehoiachin, nor does it touch on Jehoahaz, the oldest son. But as for the other three, you might really have covered this question along with number one, the historical question, and simply say that if indeed you did this. Or you could point out those three kings and the relation of Jeremiah to them, and of course this would conclude what the historical background wouldn't necessarily include, that Jehoiakim was very hostile to Jeremiah and would have liked to have killed him. But the nobles interfered and protected Jeremiah, and you'd want to point out that Zedekiah was a timid man who probably wanted to do what was right, but he's listed in the Book of Kings as having been a king who did evil, not only because he did do some things that were evil, but also because even when he wanted to do right, he didn't dare because of his fear of the leaders and the nobles of the land, who had a rather wicked attitude. Well, at least most of them did. Then question number four was, discuss Jeremiah chapter 27. Discuss this phrase, Lord, thou hast deceived me. Now, the Hebrew word there does not mean deceived. It means to lead someone into a certain direction that you would not necessarily have selected for yourself. And that could be a wicked deed. It could involve deceit, but the idea of deceit is not inherently part of the word. Now, I discussed this rather thoroughly in Lecture 8 last time, so I won't wax long this time. So let's move on to question number 5. What was Jeremiah's attitude towards the people of the Northern Kingdom? Most of what he says about them, he doesn't say much in our section that we looked at, but most of what he says is good and presents God as not having cast off the northern tribe as many people today think he did. Scripture presents Jeremiah as looking to those people who are already in exile and telling them that God is still interested in them and urging them to be faithful to God and to turn away from whatever wickedness is among them. Jeremiah makes it very clear that God has not cast them off, but God's mercy will remain with them. Moving on to number 6. List all names found in the Bible to designate any kings who reigned in Jeremiah's time. Of course, you should all know that Jehoahaz was also called Shalom, and that Jehoiachin was also called Coniah and Joachin, or Joachin, depending how you want to pronounce that. Here's a student question. Excuse me, wasn't Jehoiakim also called Eliakim? Dr. McRae's response. Yes, his name was Eliakim, but the king of Egypt changed it to Jehoiakim, so that also should be included there. Question number 7. Discuss Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. The important thing there was how in his inaugural vision Jeremiah saw an almond tree. It's a play on the Hebrew word almond and the Hebrew word watchman, but not just on words, but on the fact that the almond tree was the first one to bud in the spring when there was no other sign that spring was coming. And God is saying to Jeremiah, I'm going to do many things of which the people do not yet see any sign of. You are to be my spokesman, or watchman, to point out to them what is ahead. Here's another student question. In question number 6, does this only refer to the kings of Judah that were mentioned? And here's Dr. McRae's response. Well, that would be sufficient, yes. Yes, I didn't have in mind naming any others, but there would certainly be nothing wrong if they were named. One might point out, that would be very interesting in that connection, to point out that King Nebuchadnezzar, I think I've already mentioned, is regularly called Nebuchadrezzar here. And I believe you will find most anywhere in the Bible where a name is given in two ways. The higher critics will generally pounce on that and say it's a mistake. Somewhere the writers had it wrong. But you will never hear today anyone say that about this king, Nebuchadnezzar, I think because they recognize that Daniel, who was in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, called him the way the people there said his name, that is, Nebuchadnezzar. But that Jeremiah, who mostly knew about Nebuchadnezzar from inscriptions in writing, Jeremiah used the name that was used back in Jerusalem. And that was Nebuchadrezzar. And of course, you can't just say it's a matter of misspelling it one way or the other way, because there is no correct spelling for Nebuchadnezzar's name in Hebrew, because Nebuchadnezzar did not write in Hebrew. And it is always very difficult to transcribe names from one language to another. Here's an example. If I asked you, what is the correct way to write the name had it been in Chinese? You may see his name written in two different ways in English, and you would never dream it is the same man. And the reason is, there is doubtless one way to write his name in Chinese, but when you put it into another language, it is very hard to know how to do it. Different people may transliterate it in different ways, and there is no way to say which is right. But in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, there are these two possibilities, and the New International Version, or NIV, has regularized it. They made it Nebuchadnezzar all through, that is both in Daniel and in Jeremiah, which I would think is not very good except for the fact that they have a footnote under the first use of Nebuchadnezzar, and there they say that it can be Nebuchadrezzar at other situations, and that saves people from thinking they are really two different kings. Well, we have looked at what the questions were like for most of our time, and we have also spent a considerable amount of time already this semester on the first 20 chapters of the book, and for a fair part of that, I gave you just some rough titles for sections. It's pretty hard to really divide this part into sections, because the first 20 chapters of Jeremiah, well, they're, at least in a greater part of them, is presenting the messages that Jeremiah gave, and in those messages, his thought would go to one topic. But then he would see the need to emphasize another topic. Then he might come back to the first. It's very hard to make really important divisions among Jeremiah's thoughts sometimes. He moves rather rapidly. As is true, I would say, with most of us when we are thinking about matters very rapidly. We are apt to think about this aspect and then think of another aspect as we speak to an audience. You talk about another aspect a little, then you come back to the first. But we have, most of us, been trained to try to present things in a more logical way. 1, 2, 3, or A, B, C. We deal with this subject, then we move on to the second subject, then we move on to the third subject. But as I said, if we're excited or talking fast, we might jump back and forth between three subjects. And so Jeremiah, in these first 20 chapters, or the greater part of them, is dealing with a few primary ideas. In dealing with them, Jeremiah has many phrases. You doubtless notice that in our reading of Jeremiah, how many of his phrases have come into common use among Christians. Many verses that are often quoted without people even realizing that they came from the book of Jeremiah. He had a great ability with words, figures, and presentations, but it is not presented in the 1, 2, 3, or ABC order, which we think of as a more logical presentation. It is presented in the fire of the situation, in the difficulty of the moment, in order to try to move people in the right direction. But there is also in this section a very considerable amount of autobiographical material showing us how he felt. Not so much what happened to him, but how he felt. That material of that sort is almost entirely confined to these first 20 chapters. But there is a point at which there is a very important division in the book, and that is at the end of the first 20 chapters, because the first 20 chapters deal with Jeremiah's general message, the presentation he gave interspersed with his emotional reactions to situations, and the Lord specifically dealing with him. There are comparatively few specific references to individuals in this first part, and kings play practically no part in this first section. It is more of a general nature, and addressed mostly to the people and not dealing very specifically with the rulers of the nation. Now, this first part we could devote a whole semester to, but I don't think we would understand it nearly as well as we will after getting more an idea of what follows. That's why I've given you a good many assignments in later chapters, because they give you more of an idea of the very turbulent times in which Jeremiah lived, and of the general situations which he faced in his dealing with some of these specific situations. Now, you've got quite an idea of that, not so much from our lectures as from the material you have read, and most of that is quite clear in your reading material. So in the assignments I gave you, I believe you would feel that it tremendously improved your ability to understand the first 20 chapters. I think in the light of the remaining parts of Jeremiah, you can go back to the first section in later years, and you can find many great treasures from it. Much is tremendously useful to you, a great blessing to you, but I think much easier to understand after you have the impression of Jeremiah's general situation that you get from the latter chapters. So that is the first main section of the book, and it makes quite a unit. Chapters 1 to 20, which end with that pitiful call of Jeremiah's wishing that he had never even lived, so terrible are the problems he had to face. Though even as he gives way to these emotional expressions of this terrible misery that he has to do, yet he turns constantly to recognizing God's great leadership and God's blessing and the fact that he can put complete trust in God no matter what comes. Now, Jeremiah chapters 21 to 29 is another rather definite section of the book, and the following chapters, 31 through 34, form yet another section that is quite diverse from the first two. These are two rather sharp lines. Important divisions in the book are at the end of chapter 20 and at the end of chapter 29. And in chapters 21 through 29, the emphasis is on two features. It is Jeremiah's enunciation of the specific sins of the kings and of the false prophets. These two, the kings and the false prophets, are the main subject in these nine chapters. These nine chapters are easier to get interested in than the first 20 because there's much more personal, much more specific information about these events. In assignments, we have looked at most of these chapters. Now, we notice that these chapters are not arranged chronologically. The first 20 chapters represent a development, as we have seen before and described before, but as we have seen described in chapter 36. King Jehoiakim tried to destroy the scroll Jeremiah had written. Jeremiah makes a new scroll and adds many similar words to it. So I think we can say that the thought, the emphasis that Jeremiah had during the reign of Josiah is well expressed in chapters 1 to 20, but that it also includes elements similar to these thoughts, but written during the reign of Jehoiakim, or even possibly during that of Zedekiah. Now, chapters 21 to 29 are not arranged chronologically. About half of these chapters tell about events during the reign of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. A little less than half of them tell about events or predictions. You could not tell where it belongs chronologically except by seeing how his prophecy goes. And from that, we learn that chapter 22 must have been written in the time of Jehoiakim. The first of these chapters, chapter 21, jumps forward to the time of Zedekiah, sees the siege already in progress, and gives the message Jeremiah gave during the great siege of Jerusalem, where he told the people that God was going to give the city over to the king of Babylon, that there was nothing gained by their resisting the king of Babylon, and if they would surrender to him, God would cause that their lives would be spared. But if they continued to resist the king of Babylon, who was besieging them, they would probably lose their lives. If they didn't resist, at the very least, they would be carried off into captivity, but at least be alive. Then the 22nd chapter. We looked at it in some length a little while back, and we noticed that in the 22nd chapter, Jeremiah goes through the kings up to the time the chapter was written. And we noted he doesn't go beyond King Jehoiakim, and he predicts the end of Jehoiakim's reign. So that is quite obvious that it must be during Jehoiakim's reign that this chapter was given. We saw that in this chapter he refers back to Josiah. People tended to mourn Josiah's loss, but he said, "Don't weep bitterly for what is past. You've got worse things ahead. Don't weep bitterly for the dead king or mourn his loss. Rather, weep bitterly for him who is exiled. He will never return." Some of the people were doubtless thinking, "Pharaoh has taken the people's choice, King Jehoahaz, off into Egypt as a prisoner. Oh well, he'll come back and deliver us from this bad King Jehoiakim whom Pharaoh put over us." But Jeremiah says, "Weep bitterly for him. He will never return or see his native land again." Then Jeremiah goes on to speak about King Jehoiakim and to rebuke King Jehoiakim for his plans to build his palace by unrighteousness, and for the great luxury that he is going to live in and have no interest in the welfare of the people. He says, quote, "This is what the Lord says about Jehoiakim. They won't mourn for him. He will have the burial of a donkey, dragged away and thrown outside the gates of Jerusalem," end quote. This is Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 19. Some people say that it says in the book of Kings that he, that is King Jehoiakim, died and was taken to his fathers, that he slept with his fathers. This is 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 6. And so they go on to say that this is not a true prediction that Jeremiah made. Well, we cannot prove that it is true. Perhaps there was an uprising in which Jehoiakim was killed and his body thrown outside the city. We can't prove that. But if we believe that the book of Jeremiah was written at that time by Jeremiah himself, we know it must have been fulfilled. It is simply inconceivable that the Jewish people would have accepted as a book from God's prophet a book that made a prediction like this about Jeremiah and then not have it be fulfilled. It would have been an obvious contradiction to Jeremiah's ability to predict. Now, as the people looked at Jehoiakim and saw his meanness and his wickedness, and they said, "Oh, but wouldn't it be wonderful when he is succeeded by this fine son of his, Jehoiachin? He'll be the king, and then good times will roll again. Jehoiachin is such a grand fellow." And that's the way people in monarchies are so ready to do, to accept the young fellow they know little about. They think he is just going to be perfect when he grows up. The answer that Jeremiah gives is that this man is despised. He's a broken pot. He, that is Jehoiachin, and his children will be hurled out, cast into a land they do not know. And of course, that was fulfilled shortly afterwards. Well, I won't have time to rush through the rest of these sections, but we want to get on with that in the next section, chapters 30-34, in which Jeremiah turns away from rebuking the people and points to God's wonderful mercy in the future. So we'll continue from there next time. This is chapter and lecture number 9, Alan A. McCrae on the book of Jeremiah.